Welcome to Soundbites. I'm Mark Steiner, and we have a very special archived edition of Soundbites today. We're going to listen to some of the most interesting discussions about food over the last few months. In the second half, we're going to hear a debate about genetically modified foods with Tom Philpott, who is Mother Jones Magazine's food and agricultural correspondent, and Nathaniel Johnson, food writer for Grist. But first, here's an interview we did with Dr. Maureen Ogle about her book, In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. Dr. Maureen Ogle is a historian. Our book before this was Ambitious Brew, The Story of American Beer. Her latest book we're about to talk to you about is In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. And as a committed omnivore, I consume this book, no pun intended, and we're about to have a conversation with Maureen Ogle. And welcome to the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
So now, one of the things you begin with is saying that Americans love their meat, and that we've done so at least since the colonial period that gave Americans a chance to eat more meat they thought was possible to consume or grow.
That's right.
Or raise.
That's right. That's right. What sort of became the the guiding thematic device of the book was something I figured out pretty early on in the research, which was that during the colonial period, the people who settled what eventually became the United States encountered a world of what to them was just mind-boggling abundance. And they had come from a world where both land and food were scarce, namely Europe or England, Great Britain. But in North America, there was no one to say, hey, you can't have land, and hey, you can't eat meat. And so that's what they did, to the extent that they concluded very early on that the Native Americans already living here had no rights to the land because they did not keep domestic livestock. Native Americans didn't keep any domesticated animals. And the white Europeans who settled the Eastern Seaboard said, well, this land is ours, and what we're going to do is eat meat. And even before the American Revolution, the colonists were eating meat on a scale that visitors from Europe just found difficult to believe. They were eating it two or three times a day, which was absolutely unheard of in the old world.
Now, we do have this desire for meat, just like we have a desire for sugar. We have a desire for lots of things. I think that is a part of the human condition. And a desire for alcohol, a desire for beer, or whatever we can ferment. Most cultures are fermented, and that as well. But is it too much of a good thing? As I think about all the way in this book, I mean, yes, meat's really available. We made an industry in America that made it easy for us to consume meat because it's on the supermarket shelves. It's because of all the farm bills we've help farmers through so they survive the rough times, and it's lowered our prices of food in America to mind-bogglingly low. But is that necessarily good that we have this much access to meat? I kept wondering about that reading the book.
Well, that is the $64 million question. And as soon as you and I both answer it, we can retire and do whatever we want to do. This book I thought of as sort of the flip side of the beer book. The beer book, which came out in 2006, was sort of my love song to the notion of American opportunity. But I realized right away when I started the meat book that in a sense I was looking at the other side of the coin. If you think you're entitled to everything, if you have a sense of infinite possibility, which we Americans absolutely do, what happens when you think you can have all? And as I say, both in the introduction and the conclusion, it's not clear to me that we can keep having everything. We can't keep having five-bedroom houses out on the, you know, suburban fringe and $2 a pound ground beef and demand that we can get rid of, you know, in livestock confinement operations and industrial agriculture. We seem to want cheap food, but we don't really want to pay the price that the cheap food actually necessitates. And because we have so much cheap food, we think it's real easy to criticize our food system, which, you know, is a conundrum I'm not quite sure how we're going to get out of. I don't think we can have it all.
Well, so that's why I was wondering also as reading the book. I mean, so that's part of the contradiction, because one of the things that you kind of describe in the book and the way you approach it is the food system we have is one we've developed But, you know, it's been critiqued a lot by those who you have said don't quite understand, like Michael Pollan and others, and Eric Schlosser have written books about our food system. But is that part of our issue here that is out of control? Do you know what I mean? I mean,
yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's why in the book I went into so much detail about the emergence of the consumer economy, because as I'm sure you know, and I'm sure many of your guests have tried to explain, the critique right now about food in America tends to revolve around the idea that big corporations have taken over our food system and they control what goes on in our kitchens, and therefore our food system is broken. The point I tried to make in the book was that it doesn't make any sense to blame corporations for this. We've got exactly the food system that we American consumers want. Americans have the cheapest food in the world, and God knows we've got plenty of it. And the fact that we have so much has makes it possible for us to be this critical. But if we really want to find the enemy here, we need to go look in a mirror instead of, you know, pointing at sort of vague corporate power. I think that the problem lies within us, which I think is the main reason it's going to be so difficult for us to create any kind of substantive change. The meat system, for example, has been built over one generation after another over the past 150 years to satisfy what Americans have demanded. So as long as we continue to have this extraordinary demand for meat, Americans eat on average about 225 pounds of meat a year, a fact that I find absolutely mind-boggling. And until that changes, we're going to continue to need the system that we have right now. So, you know, we got to make a choice. Which do we want here? A lot of cheap food, or are we willing to give something up in exchange for something that we think is better?
Well, I mean, there's a couple things I was thinking about as you were speaking also that was from your book. And I because there's a lot of argument over, people can argue over what creates a consumer's desires.
Right.
The consumer's desire or what we're given. But let me take this in two parts. Earlier in your book, you talk about Gus Swift.
Right.
And so when Gus Swift helped revolutionize the way we transport meat,
mm-hmm.
I don't think he envisioned the world we have today. He was figuring out how to get meat from out west from cattle ranchers who were growing their livestock and on grass ranges, slaughtering them, getting them there, to keep the meat from deteriorating before it got to market, and,
right.
and create this whole system. But I don't think he thought about what we ended up with now. It was a very different world in 1873, which is about the time he did this, right? 1870s?
Right. Well, it was actually in the late 1870s, but that's right. I mean, one of the points I tried to make, I didn't want to like shove this in people's faces while they're reading the book, but Gus Swift was clearly a very ambitious guy, clearly very entrepreneurial, and absolutely determined to earn money doing what he did. Now, I don't think any of us can argue that that's a bad thing, right? So he set out to do what in his mind would earn him the most return for his labor, which was give consumers what they wanted, which was a whole lot of low-cost meat. And the demand was so obvious that he and people like Phil Armour managed to overturn a system of livestock production and meat delivery that had been in place for a couple of hundred years, and they did that in less than a decade. So, it wasn't like he was some big corporate behemoth. He became a big corporate behemoth because he was giving people what they wanted, and I think it's important to keep that in mind. It's so easy just to blame faceless, nameless corporate bogeymen for everything, but then that, in effect, means that we're all witless dupes, we're all victims, and I'm just not buying that argument.
Well, there's another piece that's in another book that I read. There was about a group called the Meat Price Investigators Association, which was a group formed by hundreds of feedlot operators and cattle ranchers out west. And one of the quotes from one of the pieces they say there is that the supermarkets control the ultimate consumer demand for beef by the specials they feature in their meat departments. If the wholesale price of beef threatens to move higher, then they lessen the demand for beef by either raising their prices to a level where consumers hesitate to buy or feature other items such as poultry, ham, etc. So in some ways, our desires are what is thrown at us that kind of feed on what we really want. And there's always been this constant battle between ranchers and beef growers and those who process and sell it, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That, you know, I can't get too excited about any of the current arguments about how, you know, ranchers are being ripped off or whatever, because those arguments have been made over and over. And I mean, I've been reading, I read about those, you know, 150 years ago. So that's right. But one point I will make that you brought up, and rightly so, that really surprised me when I was working on the book, was just how much power grocery chains developed in the 1920s and 1930s, because they represented the front line of consumer demand. They were grocery chains were the ones who were figuring out what it is people would buy and wouldn't buy, and grocery chains in turn translate those, or you know, transmit those demands onto meat packers, who in turn pass them on to the actual farmers, the ranchers, the livestock producers at the, you know, at the agricultural end. So it's true that grocery chains play a crucial role in all this, in making demands on food processors, but grocery chains are responding to what's going on right there on the front lines in their stores. They're watching what consumers are buying, and they've been doing that for almost 100 years. They're very powerful players, but it doesn't mean that they're manipulating our demand. They're responding to our demand.
I think that's always been the debate. Is it manipulation of demand or responding to demand?
Well, I don't regard myself as a witless dupe, and I realize this can make me very unpopular with a lot of people who are listening to this, but I just flat out don't believe that my desires are controlled. Are there plenty of weird people in the world who buy stuff that's not necessary? Of course. I just saw a staggering example. I went to a Target yesterday for the first time in about a year, and I saw a device for making breakfast sandwiches, and all I could think was, who in God's name needs a device for making breakfast sandwiches? Well, clearly somebody out there is dumb enough to buy it, but that doesn't mean that their desires are being manipulated. That just means there's a sucker born every minute, as far as I'm concerned.
Let me ask you a question before we run out of time, because there's so much here. Maybe we'll get you back another day for a roundtable, because I think this is fascinating, the stuff you raised, but it's a huge debate again, and that has to do with in your book, looking at from the very beginning of things like DES, the synthetic hormone, and where we've come to today in terms of antibiotic use, and all these reports you're reading from the government and other places about both the dangers of what it does to our resistance, what happens to the environment, but you seem to like think that it's overblown. Am I misreading you?
No. It's not that I think it's overblown. I think that people who are condemning of antibiotics, and by the way, that would include the vast majority of livestock producers who are none too happy about having to use them themselves. I was just trying, in the book, I'm just trying to explain historically why it is that livestock producers began using things like confinement, antibiotics, hormones. They didn't use it. They didn't start using it because they were being, you know, sort of led by their noses by big corporations. It was because there was a severe labor shortage and farmers needed to replace lost labor. And these things, believe it or not, actually helped them do that. This is back in the 1940s. So if we look at the historical context, it can help, I think, make more sense of these very, very complicated arguments. It's just too simple to say, oh man, those awful corporations are ruining us. Let's look at why farmers did this in the first place and then ask ourselves if we can come up with a different way of doing things.
Well, Maureen Ogle, I really want you to come back for a larger conversation. This is just one of our quick book interviews where we do these things in great depth, and look forward to you coming back. The book is In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America by Maureen Ogle. Maureen, thank you so much for your time, and please do rejoin us.
Thank you. And thanks for having Nathaniel Johnson on, man. I think that guy is the best thing to happen to the food debate in a long time.
He's fascinating.
Yes. Yeah. Bring him back.
We will.
Bring us both back together.
Okay, fine.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Welcome back, everybody, here to Soundbites, the Mark Steiner Show. We're about to talk to Tom Philpott once again, who, of course, is the food and ag correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine, who brought to us at the end of the year here the five biggest meat stories of 2013. Tom, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Mark.
How are you?
I'm all right.
You survived what was supposed to be frigid in Austin, I hope?
I am surviving.
So let's jump into these pieces that you wrote here. They are really very interesting. And I want to explore a couple of them, because one of the things I really only knew a little bit about when I read that the Shuanjui International bought the famous American Smithfield Foods, a giant pork raising and product company. I didn't think much of it other than that here companies were trading each other and buying each other back and forth. But you're saying, but this is significant in terms of what could be happening in America next, you're saying, right?
Yeah. I think it's a significant signal about where the meat industry is going. And the reason, Mark, is that Americans are eating less meat. Americans are very slightly but significantly scaling back their consumption of meat. After decades and decades of rising meat consumption, around the time of the recession, in 2008, 2009, we sort of peaked and started to creep down. And I think a variety of factors caused that. You know, people had less money, the economy was bad, health concerns. But it seems like we're in this period of at least stagnant growth in meat consumption. And that's a big problem for these meat companies because they have to show growth, profit growth, quarter after quarter after quarter, or they get punished by the stock market. And so what they're doing is they are looking outside the United States. They're